Have you ever met someone who always, I mean, always has to get the last word in? Don't look at your spouse. Don't even glance their way. Don't elbow them. Don't do that. In fact, let me change the question. Have you ever met someone other than your spouse who always has to get the last word in? Doesn't matter what the argument is over. Doesn't matter if they're right or wrong. Doesn't matter what the facts are. They don't want to be confused by the facts. There's just something within them where they feel like they have to get the last word in. Now, we spent the last 6 or 7 weeks looking at different individuals who didn't insist on having the last word. In fact, gave Jesus the last word in their lives. And they were absolutely revolutionized. Their lives were, because they didn't insist on having the last word. Their lives were absolutely transformed because they didn't insist on having the last word. So we looked at some of them. We looked at some of the first disciples that Jesus called, and one was Nathanael, you'll remember. And after he learned that Jesus was from Nazareth, he said, "Nazareth? Can anything good come from Nazareth?" That could have been his last word, but it wasn't. He gave Jesus the last word, and he became a disciple. And when Jesus challenged Nicodemus and said, "You must be born again," and Nicodemus responded by saying, "How can a man be born when he's old? Surely he cannot enter a second time into his mother's womb to be born." That could have been the last word. He could have walked away at that point, said, "This doesn't make sense," but it wasn't. And we know he too became a follower of Jesus and was one of the men who laid Jesus' crucified body in that tomb. And then when Jesus talked to that Samaritan woman at the well, and Jesus said, "Go get your husband." And she said, "I have no husband." That could have been the last word, because she knew she had been married 5 times and was now living with a guy who wasn't her husband. And she could have said, "I don't want to talk about this." And that could have been the last word, but it wasn't. She gave Jesus the last word in her relationships. She went into town and she led all these people back to Jesus. And when Jesus talked to the guy who had been paralyzed for 38 years, and Jesus said to him, "Do you want to get well?" And he responded by saying, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred." That could have been the last word. And he could have decided not to even get up when Jesus said to him, "Pick up your mat and walk." But it wasn't. And when Jesus healed that guy who had been blind since birth, and the Pharisees and his friends and neighbors and even his parents wouldn't admit it was Jesus who healed him, because that meant they would have to admit Jesus was the Messiah. And then when he was excommunicated from the synagogue, he could have caved into the pressure and gone along with everyone else. That could have been the last word. But it wasn't. And a couple weeks ago, we looked at Mary and Martha, that they sent word to Jesus that their brother was sick, that they sent word to Jesus that the one he loved, he didn't just have a summer cold, it was serious. But Jesus, who had healed so many others, delayed in going, and his friend Lazarus ended up dying. And both Mary and Martha, when they saw Jesus separately, when he finally did show up, they both said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." And that could have been the last word. They could have gotten mad and just walked away. They could have had the last word. But they gave Jesus the last word. And they saw their brother walk out of that tomb. Each one chose to give Jesus the last word. And because of that, their lives were transformed. Wounds from the past were healed. New life was given. Physical healings happened. All because they didn't insist on having the last word. But there's one person in Scripture in particular we're told about who absolutely insisted on having the last word, and I want us to look at him and his story. And I suppose the question I'll be asking all throughout this sermon is, are you insisting having the last word, or are you giving the risen, reigning Lord Jesus the last word in your life and in your relationships and in your marriage and in your family and in the situation you're facing? Are you giving him the last word, or are you insisting on having the last word? You know the one who insisted on having the last word. His name was Judas. On that Friday when Jesus was crucified, two hills were climbed that day, and there were two trees. They may have even have been within eyesight of each other, I don't know. Both climbed by choice. Both trees had men hanged from them. Both men chose to be hanged from those separate trees on those separate hills. But one of those men said, "I will do it my own way. I get the last word." And the other said, "Not my will, but your will be done." The scripture gives us some snapshot pictures of Judas, whether it was seeing him criticize Mary for pouring perfume on Jesus and saying, "Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It's worth a year's wages." And that sounded awfully holy of him. Or whether it was seeing him when in the upper room getting his feet washed by Jesus, knowing that he was about to go out and betray Jesus. Or whether it was seeing him lead the soldiers to Jesus and then identifying Jesus by kissing him on the cheek. Or whether it was seeing him take his own life when he realized the magnitude of what he had just done. In every snapshot we see of him, we see him insisting, "I want my way. I'm going to do it myself. I can do this thing myself." In fact, I want you to turn over to Matthew 27. We're going to read the first 10 verses. Matthew chapter 27. This is what it says. "Early in the morning, all the chief priests and elders of the people came to the decision to put Jesus to death. They bound him, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate, the governor. Then Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned. He was seized with remorse and returned the 30 silver coins to the chief priests and the elders. 'I have sinned,' he said, 'for I have betrayed innocent blood.' 'What is that to us?' they replied. 'That's your responsibility.' So Judas threw the money into the temple and left. Then he went away and hanged himself. The chief priest picked up the coins and said, 'It's against the law to put this into the treasury since it's blood money.' So they decided to use the money to buy the potter's field as a burial place for foreigners. That is why it has been called the field of blood to this day. Then what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. They took the 30 silver coins, the price set on him by the people of Israel, and they used them to buy the potter's field as the Lord commanded me." And this picture of Judas shows us so clearly how even in the wake of his failure and feeling tremendous guilt for what he did, still he was insisting on having the last word. I don't know about you, but oftentimes when I read the Bible, I find my face in the white spaces between the black letters. I'd like to be able to tell you that I see my own face when I read about David and his courage to face Goliath, when I know I have some giant Goliath-like problems in my life. Or when I read the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, I'd love to say to myself, "Boy, that's me. That's the kind of faith I have." But more often than not, it's when I read the story of like that dad with the kid who was demon-possessed and he kept throwing himself into the fire or the water and foaming at the mouth, and the disciples had tried to heal the boy and they couldn't do it. And Jesus asked this dad if he believed he could heal his son, and the dad said, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." And when I read those words, I see my own face staring back at me, because I've said that to God. I believe. Help my unbelief. Or when I read about Peter and him bragging how he would never, ever deny the Lord. He was so sure of himself. He was so cocky. But then he went out and did the very thing he bragged he would never do. And there have been times when I read that and I see myself. But I could never imagine myself seeing myself in Judas. Not me. I would never be a traitor. I would never be the one to betray Jesus. I would have never been the one to lead the soldiers up to him, lead those who are going to arrest him and kiss him on the cheek as a way to identify him. I could never see myself in Judas. But then as I read it right in between those black letters, I saw my own face staring back at me, and I wondered, I ever responded that way? Have I ever insisted on having the last word? Have I ever insisted on handling my own failure, my guilt, my way, and I haven't given Jesus the last word? Has there ever been a time when as soon as I did something or said something, I knew I was wrong, I wish I hadn't done it, but then I handled it my own way and not God's way? You see, that's exactly what Judas did. We just read it. There was a moment in time when all of a sudden Judas realized what he did was wrong. But instead of turning to God, instead of running to Jesus, rather than giving Jesus the last word, he decided to handle it his own way. So he walked up a hill, threw a hangman's noose over a branch, and he hanged himself. We just read it. Verses 3 and 4, when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 silver coins to the chief priests and the elders. "I have sinned," he said, "for I have betrayed innocent blood." And then it says in verse 5, so Judas threw the money into the temple and left. Then he went away and he hanged himself. It says he was seized with remorse. All of a sudden, the full magnitude of what he had done hit him. If he could have hit the delete button, he would have done it. If he could have pushed the clock back a day, he would have done it. But he couldn't. So he decided he would handle his guilt, his sin, his choices, his own way. He decided he was going to have the last word. And he did. You understand, he had been with Jesus for 3 years. He had seen Jesus forgive prostitutes and those who committed adultery. He had seen Jesus reach out and set men and women free who had done terrible and perverted things because they were demon-possessed. He had been taught by Jesus that sin is sin, and there is no level or distinction in sin, and all a person has to do is repent and he would discover the forgiveness and the grace of God. Judas knew all of that, but he still chose to handle his sin and guilt. He was remorseful, but he wasn't repentant. He was sorry, but he wasn't repentant. And so he took his own life. He had the last word. And I want us to look at the cause. That's the letter A in your notes, the cause. Now, I read every commentary I could find, and there are many different opinions on why Judas did what he did, why he was the betrayer. Number one, plain and simple, many have said the cause was money. Matthew's the one who tells us. He went to the chief priest asking, "What are you willing to give me if I hand him over to you?" So many have said, there it is, that's the reason, that's the cause, plain and simple. Judas wanted that 30 pieces of silver that was offered. Others have said the motive stemmed, number two, from embezzlement. John tells us that Judas was the one that was very critical of Mary, who poured the perfume on Jesus' feet. And he said that perfume could have been sold and the money could have been given to take care of the poor. But John also lets us know the reason Judas said that was because he was a thief. John wrote, he did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put in it. So there are those that speculate the reason why Judas betrayed Jesus for 30 pieces of silver was to cover his tracks so no one would find out that he was a thief. A third motive that has been speculated about is that Judas was demon-possessed. Both Luke and John tell us that when Judas took the piece of bread at the Passover meal from Jesus, that the devil entered into him. John said, as soon as Judas took the bread, Satan entered into him. And Luke said, then Satan entered Judas, called Iscariot, and Judas went to the chief priest. So there are those that say the cause of the betrayal was demon possession. And then one other motive that has been suggested is nationalism. This theory goes that Judas didn't really want Jesus to die, but he was hoping he could force Jesus to take a militant stand against the Romans. That Judas' concept of the Messiah was that he would be a military and political leader. And so he was just trying to force Jesus to take on that role by betraying him. And it wasn't until he saw Jesus being led away, condemned, like Matthew told us, that he realized that wasn't going to happen. Now, you know what? Some or all or none of that could have played in Judas' thinking. But I am absolutely convinced that at the core of why Judas did everything he did was the insistence that he wanted to do things his own way. He wanted to call the shots. He didn't want to do things God's way unless God's way happened to be to his own advantage and he could get something out of it. He even wanted to be a disciple of Jesus on his own terms. And so he held so firmly to that way of thinking that even when he was overwhelmed with sorrow and guilt and remorse, he still said, I'm going to handle this my own way. I'm going to have the last word. If you're like me, you don't even want to think that there are any similarities between you and Judas the traitor. But pause and answer this question to yourself. When there has been failure on your part, when all of a sudden you realize what you did was hurtful or sinful, and the guilt and the remorse is overwhelming, it seems like it's more than you think. How have you responded? Have you tried to handle it on your own? Have you run from it or denied it or hid it or got defensive or beat yourself up and told yourself what a terrible person you are? You're just getting what you deserve. Have you ever gotten to the point where you really thought, man, maybe suicide is the way to escape the guilt. And besides, everyone would be better off without me. Have you or are you trying the best you can to handle it your own way rather than God's way? I want you to know, more than anything else, I want you to know that God will give you chance after chance after chance to respond to your failure, your sin, your guilt, your remorse, his way. He won't even wait for you to seek him out. He will come seeking you out. He will come and it will make you a startling offer of grace. He will say to you and me, let me have the last word in this. I want you to notice from Judas' story all the chances he was given to give up his own way and accept God's way in his grace. Letter B in your notes, the chances. I want you not only to see it, but I want you to feel the full impact of the many chances Jesus extended to Judas before the betrayal and after the betrayal. At any time, he could have turned to God. At any time, he could have said, Jesus, you've got the last word. He did not have to take his own life. At any moment before his neck snapped and the tree limb broke and he went crashing into the rocks below, he could have turned to Jesus and found forgiveness and grace. First in John 13:2, we're told, the evening meal was being served and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Being prompted is just another word for temptation. And Judas had been with Jesus long enough to know that just because the devil tempts you, that doesn't mean you have to do it. I am sure that Jesus had taught many times what Peter would later write. Be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Resist him, standing firm in your faith. And the God of all grace will himself restore you and make you strong and firm and steadfast. Judas had to have known when temptation came, that was an opportunity to receive grace, to receive what he would need to stand firm and resist. But instead of turning to God, he said, I can handle temptation on my own. I think a second offer of grace was extended when Jesus washed Judas' feet. John 13:12 says, when he had finished washing their feet, that meant Jesus left no one out. That meant he knelt before Judas, picked up his dirty, grimy feet that had already carried Judas to the temple to bargain with the chief priests. Jesus took his would-be betrayer's feet and gently washed them. I believe with all my heart, in that moment, Jesus was giving Judas a chance to say, Lord, I did something terrible. Please forgive me. The chance and the offer of grace was given, but it was refused. Number three was at the Passover meal also. Mark tells us that during that meal, Jesus told them point blank, one of the 12, would be the betrayer. He was letting them know, I know. And he was especially letting Judas know he knew. I have to believe when Jesus said, it is one of the 12, that had to have struck at the very core of Judas' heart. He must have thought, oh no. But it was another chance, another opportunity to say, Lord, I know you know it's me. Please forgive me. But he ignored the offer of grace. Number four, same meal, a warning is given. This time Jesus said, woe to the man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born. Judas was still there. He heard the warning. He even responded by saying, surely not I, Rabbi. And Jesus answered him, looked him right in the eye and said, yes, it is you. Now there could be no question in Judas' mind. Judas knew. Jesus knew. Jesus warned him what would happen, told him it was him. And you would think that Judas would have fallen on his face and said, Lord, I'm so sorry. I don't know what I was thinking. I think that warning and that identification was Jesus extending another offer of grace. And Judas continued to be his bullheaded self and refused the grace that was being offered and insisted, I get the last word in this. Number five, same meal, another missed opportunity. This time others knew that Judas is the betrayer. John asked Jesus who the betrayer is. And John 13:26 says, Jesus answered, it is the one to whom I give this piece of bread when I have dipped it in this dish. Then dipping the piece of bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot. So now others knew. And that should have motivated Judas to come clean. But he still was going to handle this his own way. He must have thought, I don't care if others know. Number six happened when the devil entered him. John 13:27 went on to say, as soon as Judas took the bread, Satan entered into him. That should have scared the bejeebers out of him. He should have cried out to Jesus. He had seen Jesus set others free from the grip of Satan. He knew what Jesus could do. But he sat there silently until Jesus finally said to him, go and do what you have to do. And he got up and he left and he walked away from that chance of grace. Amazing. Number seven happened after the betrayal had happened in Judas' heart. After what Judas only thought about doing, but now he actually did it. Matthew tells us how when Judas came, he came leading the soldiers to arrest Jesus. Jesus addressed Judas directly. He didn't call him a betrayer. He didn't call him a traitor. He didn't call him a dirty dog, a dirty scum-sucking dog. He said, friend. Friend, do what you came for. You understand when Jesus called this man he loved friend, he was letting Judas know he had not gone too far. He wasn't out of options. He could still find grace. He could still be forgiven. But he refused. Number eight happened in the same conversation. For Luke tells us that at the same time Jesus said to Judas, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? You see, Jesus was not going to let Judas sidestep or rationalize away what he was doing. He was betraying not just some man, not even a rabbi, but he was betraying the Son of Man, the Messiah, with a kiss. And when the full weight of that realization of what he was doing to Jesus hit him, he should have fallen on his knees and begged for forgiveness. But that was not Judas' way of handling failure and betrayal. He always wanted to have the last word. Number nine, we have already read, Matthew 27:3 says, when Judas saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse. He was now feeling all the guilt of the world. He was now realizing the full consequences of his decisions and actions. Because of what he did, Jesus was going to die. And I'm persuaded that guilt and that remorse that he was feeling was just another attempt by God to reach out to Judas, an opportunity to repent, to run to God and say, I'm sorry, please forgive me. But one more time, one final time, he refused. though his decision was the vilest, most selfish decision ever made and led directly to Jesus' death, still he was given chance after chance after chance to be forgiven and to experience anew the grace of God. And folks, that brings us to the choice we are all faced with. Letter C in your notes, the choice. It's the very same choice that Judas faced. While Jesus was climbing up a hill called Calvary, Judas was climbing another hill. While Jesus was being nailed to an old rugged tree, Judas was throwing a hangman's noose over a different tree. You see, the decision to betray wasn't really the big deal for Judas. Jesus would have been crucified on that cross with or without Judas. If not Judas, then someone else. What he did wasn't really the big deal. But his last choice was. For he chose to the very end to do things his way and to have the last word. So he chose to be remorseful, but not repentant. He chose to be sorry, but not to have godly sorrow. He chose suicide over salvation. All because he insisted on handling his sin, his wrong choices, his own way. And folks, the reason Judas' story is so disturbing to me is because I know there was a time in my own life when I tried to live my own Christian life by Judas' motto. I'll do it my way. I'll be a follower of Jesus my way. And it disturbs me now because I see Christian people I love who are trying to live their Christian life by that same motto. I'll do it my way. I'll do this Christian thing my own way. I know the word says forgive, but I'm going to handle relationships my way. I know the word tells me the kind of spouse I should be, but I'm going to do it my way. I know what the word says about holy living and being sexually pure. I'm going to do it my way. I know what the word says about gossip or out of control anger or jealousy or how I handle my finances, but I'm going to do it my way. I get to have the last word. And then when the consequences of those decisions hit them, instead of running to the outstretched arms of Jesus, instead of receiving forgiveness and grace and the new start that's being offered, they even handle guilt their own way. They'll run from God or run to a bottle or run from one relationship to another, or they'll beat themselves up by saying, I don't deserve to be forgiven. And somehow they think they'll feel better if they carry all this guilt around with them. Or some have even chosen suicide. Folks, if you see yourself in Judas' story even a little bit, this right now, right while we're here, is an opportunity being extended to you to receive the grace of Jesus Christ. He is reaching out to you and is saying, quit insisting on handling it your own way. Come to me and find the grace and the forgiveness and the new start and a new power and a new life. Maybe you've been told you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you're not pretty enough, you're not athletic enough, you're too old, too young, too many problems, too much trouble, too many bad habits, you swear too much, you drink too much, get angry too much, mess up too much. Listen, none of those words have to be the last word in your life. God specializes in speaking new words, new hope, new life, grace, forgiveness. There's a Nazarene pastor who pastors a church in Porterville, California. His name is Mark, and about 2 weeks ago or so, he received a very strange phone call. Sometimes we pastors get those things, believe it or not. Well, this local funeral home called him up and asked Mark if he would officiate at a funeral. That wasn't strange. That happens. Family, maybe they're from out of town, or maybe they don't have a home church, but they want a Christian funeral for their loved one. So the funeral home calls around looking for a pastor. So Mark received a phone call asking him to officiate at a funeral. The deceased, you may have heard of him, Charles Manson. For you younger ones, maybe you don't know who Charles Manson is. Charles Miles Manson was a cult leader, criminal. In the late 1960s, he formed what became known as the Manson Family, a quasi-commune in California. Manson's followers committed a series of 9 murders over 4 locations in July and August of 1969. 1971, he was convicted of first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder for the deaths of seven people, all of which were carried out at his instructions by members of this group. He spent the rest of his life in prison. He died November 17, 2017. And so for the last 4 months, his dead body was at a morgue as four people made claims for the deceased's remains and what few possessions he had. Finally, a judge awarded the remains to Charles Manson's grandson, a guy named Jason Freeman. And that's when this Nazarene pastor got involved. I'm part of a group text of friends, and so somebody in the group asked Mark what he was going to say. What do you say at Charles Manson's funeral? This is what Mark wrote back. He said, I shared how Charlie was born in an unhealthy environment to a 16-year-old mother, unprepared to care for him, and that environment followed him the rest of his life. I stated that every choice we make, there is a positive result or negative consequence, and many choices that were thrust on him were destructive and damaging to him as a young boy. He then made choices that were destructive and damaging to others throughout his lifetime. I shared that he was known only by his number in the correctional system. But to those who had gathered to the service, he was known as son, husband, father, grandfather, and friend. And this was their time to pay final respects and say goodbye. And then he said, but then I shared Jason's story. Again, Jason is the grandson, whose dad had committed suicide in part because of the stigma that went along with being the son of Charles Manson. But somewhere in there, Jason became a Christian. And Mark, the pastor, said, Jason, broke the pattern of the past and began a new beginning for his family as a father to his boy and husband to his wife. He was transformed by the resurrected Jesus and the family he came from and the hurts of the past and what others thought didn't have the final word in his life, but the resurrected Jesus had the final word. The legacy of Charles Manson didn't have the final word for his grandson. The resurrected Jesus had the final word. But it's not just true for Charles Manson's grandson. I've told you before my dad's story many times. He came from a long line of alcoholics. His grandparents were alcoholics. His dad was an alcoholic. His mom died when he was 2 years old, falling out of a second-story window because she was so drunk. He was raised by his sister, dropped out of high school, got married, had four kids, was barreling down the road to divorce, and making the same life choices of his dad and his grandfather and his great-grandfather. But then he met the resurrected Jesus. Alcohol didn't have the final word. The resurrected Jesus had the final word. And there are people in this room. Maybe your past contains some things that you're not very proud of. Maybe you've even committed crimes, found yourself in prison from those crimes, paid your debt to society. But those crimes and that prison doesn't have to have the final word. The resurrected Jesus, King Jesus, can have the final word in your life. There are others in this room who have fallen under the grips of drugs and alcohol. They've ripped you apart. They ripped your family apart. They have a grip on you, a stranglehold. But drugs and alcohol don't have to have the final word. The resurrected Jesus, King Jesus, can have the final word in your life. There are others in this room who have gone from one bad relationship to another. It seems the only thing they're good at finding is not Mr. Right, but finding Mr. Wrong. They have heartache and trouble and brokenness throughout their life. But I'm here to tell you, heartache doesn't have to have the final word. The resurrected Jesus, King Jesus, can have the final word. As surely as Jesus offered Judas forgiveness and grace and a new start, as surely as Jesus was saying to his betrayer, let me have the last word. He's saying that to every person in this room. Let me have the last word. And the last word is grace. What are you going to do? Keep insisting, I get the last word. I get my way. Or are you going to let King Jesus have the last word and accept his offer of grace? Bow your heads with me.